Brent, thank you for an absolutely outstanding scene setter, as you put it. You really helped us get started at a very, very high level of assessment. You've kindly agreed to take questions for 10 or 15 minutes. There are three microphones, and as is our pattern, would you please queue up? We'll sort of move across the room sequentially. Please identify yourself, your name, and your organization, and then state your question briefly. But thank you. Please.
Takeshi Yamashita, NHK Japan Broadcasting. President Bush decided to seek congressional approval before taking action against Iraq. And he will consult with Permanent Five and key allies. And is the Bush administration in the right direction under the influence your essay in the Wall Street Journal? And do you think the Bush administration should seek UN Security Council resolution?
Well, these are very complex issues. And for the United States, the first one is a fundamental constitutional issue. The first Bush administration debated these same issues. And it was, I am not a constitutional scholar, it was my feeling that the Constitution, which makes the President Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, has to mean that he can deploy and use those armed forces, otherwise Commander-in-Chief means nothing. But the Congress has the sole right to declare war. In this case, a constitutional scholar said the Constitution is an invitation to struggle on this point. And I won't pursue that any further. I think that all of the things that I discussed are in one way or another connected with each other. You can't pick one out and say we're going to concentrate on this and forget all the others. We live in a world of great complexity, and we don't control all the levers. Our fundamental focus is the war on terrorism. And to win that war, I hope I've emphasized enough, we have to have international cooperation. Okay?
Thank you, General.
One over here.
Chuck Cogan, Kennedy School. I'd like to congratulate you, General, on a talk that was both incisive and elusive. And I'd like to go to this image of the billboard and the replacement of bin Laden by Saddam Hussein. Last week there was a story in the Washington Post which seemed to have sunk like a stone, to the effect that certain senior al-Qaeda leaders by name are located in eastern Iran in guest houses. And isn't that the real enemy? Isn't that worthy of a preemptive strike? This is a deplacement, as you indicated, of where the enemy is. Thank you.
That's a very good question. And what it illustrates to me is the incredible complexity of this situation we face, and the need for what I would call exquisite diplomacy. In the months after 9/11, there were a number of signs of cooperation between the United States and Iran. And after all, Iran and the Taliban had little in common. They're both fundamentalist strains, but one is Sunni and the other is Shia. And so there was the possibility of cooperation there. That has now eroded in several respects. Iran wants to keep its influence in Afghanistan, and we're not particularly happy about that. Iran sent a boatload of arms to the Palestinians and so on and so forth. So that has eroded. what the exact situation of any Al-Qaeda who may be in Iran, I don't know. But I think you're absolutely right in the sense that that's where our focus needs to be. It doesn't necessarily mean we have a bombing attack on the villages where the Al-Qaeda people supposedly are. There are many ways to do it. But it points out that we have to have all different kinds of levers that we're prepared to use in order to achieve our end. It is not going to be pretty, and it's not going to happen soon.
Please.
Thank you, sir. I'm Elena Poptodorova, Ambassador of Bulgaria to Washington. I would also like to express my appreciation, and I was really impressed by your overview, General, of the situation. You indicated a tendency of a return to great power politics, which does seem to be the case. How would you comment or analyze the situation of aspirant countries? We have declared, and not only that, we proved by actual deed that we want to be and have been de facto allies of US and NATO, particularly in the war against terror. On the other hand, we are conducting hopefully successful negotiations with the EU for full membership there, expecting at the same time to get invitations to join NATO in Prague. How do you view our situation in this rather peculiar relationship that has emerged on both sides of the Atlantic? Thank you.
I think the relationship between the EU and NATO has always been a complex one, and membership is not interchangeable, but in a sense it is, and it is going to get more complicated, I think, with the expansion of NATO. I frankly think that when NATO gets another 5 or even 7 more members, that we need to look at an evolution of that alliance. We need to look at the relationship more closely, the military relationship of membership in the EU, and what that means as the EU integrates the ESDP, European Security and Defense Program, what that means and how we can bridge any gaps. It again is a reason that we need to have a useful dialogue with the Europeans, and I'm afraid it's pretty thin right now.
Let me just say we've got a little over 5 minutes left, so we'll take the questions we have now unless people go on too long. Please.
Sir, Rob Warren, a consultant. You mentioned that we need to disaggregate the terrorist threat and focus on those elements that are a real threat to U.S. national security. Former President Carter, in an op-ed piece in the Post this morning, suggested that some elements of the administration have tried to capture the terrorist threat to be more pervasive, and, for example, focusing on the poster of Saddam. Would you care to comment?
Not really. I've already made that comment. Saddam is a problem. There's no question about it. He's an evil man. We've recognized him as a member of the close community of rogue states for some time. But fundamentally, Saddam Hussein is not a problem because of terrorism. He's a problem because of Saddam Hussein. And he has ambitions in the region. He's instigated 2 wars now. And I think we can assume that he's trying to get prepared for another one or somehow to dominate his region. We need to understand Saddam, where he's coming from. We need to focus on him, but not to the extent that we take our focus away from other issues. And as I say, all of these, I cannot overemphasize, All of these are interrelated issues, and every step you take on one of them will have an impact on the others. And this is a time for a grand strategy.
Thank you.
Dayton Maxwell from USAID. You said two things very important to us in USAID, that nation building is an essential part of the process, and that more economic aid itself won't work. Need to find a way to reach out to bring the poor countries into more modern technology. How would you advise us in USAID or the U.S. government to use foreign assistance more effectively in this new challenge?
That's a really tough one. We have tried a variety of different methods, and I don't know that there is a model that you could demonstrate works. You can certainly take the model of the Asian tigers who profited by American assistance and so on. Was it the American assistance, or were they going to succeed anyway, and we just provided them the capital to do it? It is very hard, but I think we have a different problem now. One of the problems of economic aid is, of course, we provided it through governments, and some of these governments have sticky fingers, and it hasn't always been utilized effectively for the purposes we want rather than for political purposes of the local regime. I really don't have an answer, but I think it goes far beyond simple economic aid. I think we have to look at a number of these small countries. You know, the first requirement of any government is to provide for the security of its people. Most of the countries of the world can't do that, can't even begin to. And so the people are buffeted by forces that they don't understand, like, for example, the 98 crisis in Asia. Capital simply was sucked out overnight. How do you expect the rice farmer in Thailand to understand what's happening to him? We need to really think how to go about this, because if we don't go at the roots, we won't win. You know, wars don't solve problems. Wars just decide who's going to solve the problem. And we now have Afghanistan, and there's been a lot of repugnance at the notion of nation building and peacekeeping and so on, and our forces aren't geared for that and so on. But if we don't do it, take Afghanistan as an example, in another decade, we'll be back in rooting the terrorists out of Afghanistan all over again. So this is a crucial part of it, and I would throw the question back to you all, who get paid for thinking about these things.
Thank you.
Brent Dick Smizer, professor at Georgetown University. You've hinted at a lot of different things that we should be doing, and they all make sense. But I wondered, as a kind of conclusion, if you could give us the one or two key elements of a grand strategy which you regard as the single most important points on which we should focus at this time. I'm trying to see if we can get from you a kind of fusion of your ideas into a couple of dominant concepts.
I think the threat of, let's call it Al-Qaeda, that probably is too formal, much more shadowy than that. It is sometimes owned by Al-Qaeda. In some places, it's just local malcontents whom Al-Qaeda trains, uses, teaches them how to falsify documents, all those kinds of things. That is our biggest problem, because we don't really know how to do it. Will terrorism destroy the United States? No. No, of course not. Will it make life miserable? It already has. Just one attack. It already has and it could get much worse. So I think that is the real focus. And for there, we need to relook at intelligence, at cooperation with our friends and allies, and deepening it, and maybe do it in different ways, but also at home. And we've been sort of happy with the intelligence community as it is. The border of the United States is a huge border when it comes to intelligence, because CIA stops at the U.S. border and the FBI begins. They're not only two different organizations, they're two different cultures. It didn't matter very much during the Cold War because the problem was overseas. And other than some counterintelligence difficulties, cooperation wasn't important. U.S. borders mean absolutely nothing to terrorists. And so you've got to have a seamless flow of our ability to deal with them across these borders. That's very hard for us to do. And we have to learn better ways to intercept these people and still protect the privacy of Americans. I think it can be done. I think it can be done by machines so that an individual name doesn't turn up in front of other people until it has been filtered through a number of keywords and phrases and so on. I'm going on too long, but Dick, that's where I think our focus is. And if we really home in on it, I think we can make it from a threat to a nuisance. Well, I won't put a time on it. It'll take several years, but we can do it.
We're close to the end, but we'll take the three if you can make them brief, please.
Lynn Joyner, Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. I was struck by your comments about the need for more international cooperation and the interdependency of all of us as we fight this fight. But when you look at the newspaper today, not only did Jimmy Carter start to worry about the role of the United States and how we are looked at, but Secretary of State Powell had a rather uncomfortable time in Johannesburg, and there's an article about the fact President Bush was one of the few leaders who didn't show up for that. And there's also an ad begging the United States Congress to pay its back dues to the United Nations. What kind of report card would you give to the Bush administration for its efforts to improve its international cooperation? And how can you think that we're really going to win this war if we don't accept the idea of being interdependent?
Well, I'm not in the business of putting out report cards. But let me say, this is a world where, in our own interest, we need to reach out. Not just to be nice to people, not to be loved. We're not going to be loved anyway. We are such an overwhelming presence in the world, people are going to resent us just because of that. But there's very little we can do all by ourselves. Allies can be vexatious, they can be troublesome, they interfere with the purity of our operations and so on and so forth. But the fact is, if you look at it, we cannot...
...that September 11th happened because of something went wrong with America's foreign policy before.
Did something go... Did it 9/11 happen because of something that went wrong in American foreign policy before? I don't really think so. There are a lot of postmortems now. What did we know? Did we drop the ball? We had precursors from the first Trade Center bombing to the embassy bombings and so on and so forth. I don't think so. You can always argue in retrospect, but we look at it differently than we did during the decade of the 90s. And, you know, the decade of the 90s was one huge sigh of relief out from under the burden of the Cold War. And I think, you know, it's easy to criticize, but I think we can be excused for not wanting to focus on a lot of things. The American people didn't pay much attention to foreign policy. The readership, TV followership of news declined dramatically over the decade. It wasn't because we're isolationists or don't really care. It just didn't, foreign affairs didn't impinge on our lives, and so we didn't pay any attention to it. I think 9/11 was a serious wake-up call. But now I think there's some danger that its effects are perhaps not long-lasting enough to keep us galvanized.
Final question.
Yes, Nicholas Berry, foreignpolicyforum.com. Your op-ed piece was designed to stimulate a debate over the policies advocated by what are called unilateralists and multilateralists. Now, are you satisfied with the nature of that debate?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question. I think there is a useful airing of views at the present time. And I think we can only profit by it, the American people, and our governmental leadership. This is not an easy world. It is a new world in the sense of the primary problem, one that we or nobody else has really had to deal with the way we have. It's hard to know what works. We have this wonderful military machine, which doesn't exactly fit what we're trying to do with terrorism. If you look at another example of the Israelis, next to the United States, the Israeli army is probably the highest tech in the world. They never lose an engagement in the Palestinian areas. But are they winning? You know, that's the nature of the problem we face, and I think we're all feeling our way, and I think that to the extent that issues are not highly sensitive, that a debate about them is one of the best ways to come to a sound resolution of them. Thank you very much.